This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, officials with Kalamazoo Communities in Schools tell us about their $4.5 million fundraising campaign. But first, the role of women in the beginning of the computer age. In her autobiography, Pioneer Programmer, Jean Jennings Bardick writes, "Betty Snyder and I programmed the problem the ENIAC ran that first day of the computer era. We were two of a team of six computer programmers for the ENIAC, all women. We six women were the first computer programmers in the world." Jean Jennings Bardick passed away in 2011, but we're going to discuss her role in the beginning of the computer age with her son, Tim Bardick, well known to our audience as an economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Gordon.
We're also joined by Kathy Kleiman. She's an internet law and policy attorney, and she's also the founder of the ENIAC Programmers Project and executive producer of a documentary about the ENIAC programmers. She is joining us via Skype. Thank you for being here, Kathy.
Thank you for having me, Gordon.
Tim, I want to begin with you. There's a phrase that your mom uses in this book a couple times that she apparently really liked. Luck beats brains. And she does say good fortune allowed her to be part of this group of programmers. But she had both, right? Luck and brains.
Well, luck and brains, and I also think willingness to take risk when other people might not have taken risk. She came from a farm background in Missouri. The easiest path for her, she went to college, was a math major, was to become a high school math teacher. And her dad kind of wanted her to do that, stick around home. And her college professors kind of said, well, that would be an acceptable thing for a woman to do back in 1945. But she just said, no, I want to go to a big city. I want to have an adventure. And she saw an advertisement to become a computer, which was actually a job title then.
That's the name, right?
Yeah.
Not computer
program. And she was hired as a computer to do these calculations at Penn. And then when the opportunity came around to become a programmer, or I'm not sure they called them programmers then, but there was an advertisement for a different role, she signed up for that. She was the second alternate, but the other two alternates turned it down because they would have had to move to Aberdeen and give up housing and this and that. But she jumped at it. So I think she was lucky in that some of these opportunities came up, and that she just happened to hear about the ads or hear about the openings. But she also was someone who was willing to take some risk and undergo some discomfort in order to do something really exciting.
It's one thing to get an opportunity. It's a whole nother thing to have the gumption and the wherewithal to take advantage of it.
Right. And I think she definitely had that. It's too bad she passed away before this book came out, because it's hard to convey her personality by remote. She had a very powerful personality. She was one of those mothers who was a force of nature. As Kathy could attest, she was a very powerful personality and definitely made an impression on just about everyone she met.
Kathy, how did you first learn about Jean Jennings Bardick and these other women who were part of the ENIAC project?
Well, it's interesting, Gordon, because at the time they did their work during World War II, they weren't credited. In 1946, when the ENIAC was unveiled, it had been a secret army project during World War II. But after the war, when this experimental computer actually worked, they unveiled the project and the army got credit. The hardware engineers got credit. The inventors got credit, Eckert and Mockley. But the programmers didn't get credit. And there are lots of reasons for that. But they didn't get credit. And so 40 years later, I found pictures of the ENIAC, which is, you know, a huge machine. It stood 8 feet tall, 80 feet long. It was black. And there were people in the picture, and the men were in the captions and the women weren't. And I asked who the women were, and that led to finding them and learning the story. Because I was initially told they were models, just kind of posed in front of the machine to make it look good. But of course they weren't. And when I started hearing their stories, I realized everyone should know this amazing story of these amazing six programming pioneers.
The original story you were told is they were probably like the women you see in advertisements for refrigerators.
Exactly. I was told they were refrigerator ladies. Exactly.
In her book, she describes that first public presentation of the ENIAC and then how the women programmers were just ignored afterward. And there's sort of a real bittersweet feeling when you read those passages. And it also, in a way, Tim, sort of sets the stage for what happened for many decades thereafter, right?
Well, right. 100% of the first computer programmers were women. But basically, since then, the role of women as programmers has declined significantly. Certainly you know, my mom faced those pressures. I mean, you know, after the war, you know, when they didn't need women as much because the men were back from the war, she faced a number of barriers to moving ahead in the computer industry, and that continues today. And, you know, certainly one reason my mom wanted to write the book was that I think it's important to young women today to know that there are these female role models. Role models matter. Who you see doing different types of scientific and technical things, if all you see are men, you think that's something only men can do. You know, but basically, she did this very important work, and then, you know, it was kind of underplayed even at the time. I think partly because originally they didn't necessarily think of programming as being very important. I mean, the thinking was what was really important was the hardware, and they hired some women to do the programming, but that wasn't necessarily thought to be as high level as a thing. Now, of course, as the computer developed, it became quite apparent over time that we all know that software is at least as important as hardware in making computers useful for everyday life.
Kathy, you're in this field now. Is there some movement in the direction of women getting more recognition, getting more involved in any way?
Gordon, women are involved at every level of technology right now. We see them as head of as CEOs of technology companies. We see them as programmers. We see them at all levels of technology development, but they're not broadly represented. Women still feel like minorities in many of these positions. And that's why role models do matter and pioneers do matter. And they matter not just to inspire the girls and boys coming through the system to encourage them to study technology, but they matter to the people in the field like me who, you know, kind of face a bit of bias or often the only women in the room sometimes professionally. And, you know, it's nice to know. It's a confidence builder to know that there were role models and pioneers who were women. So, but in terms of changing the history, Jean's book is huge for being an autobiography that sets out the story for the first time of the ENIAC programmers. And that's tremendous. I think it will help change the history that's reflected in the textbooks. And that will be great going forward.
Do you hope that the documentary that you continue to work on will also in some way perhaps build on that and get more of that history out there?
Absolutely. I had the great good fortune to tape four of the original six ENIAC programmers in 1997, very long, very extensive broadcast quality oral histories. And those are the basis of the documentary short that I'm working on that will be finished very shortly. And so you get to hear not just me talking about the history, but much more importantly, hear the ENIAC programmers themselves telling their story. And it's really wonderful. And so, yes, I hope lots and lots of students across the country will see this documentary and learn the history.
Later in the book, Jean Jennings Bardach writes of her time at Auerbach and says, "I'd like to think that I put a crack in the glass ceiling that so many women found themselves bumping up against. It was a small crack, but a crack nevertheless." Tim, is she selling herself short there? Is it more than a small crack she put in the glass ceiling?
Well, she put a crack in the ceiling. She didn't was not able to get ahead at some of the companies as much as she wanted. She had some pretty high level positions, but she talks about in that job at Auerbach. I mean, she basically didn't get various promotions. None of the women at the company got promoted. They were quite willing to have them be technical editors, but they didn't really want to move them to the higher level management positions. And she at one point considered suing. I mean, she went to the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission and talked to them, and they told her she had a very good case and she probably would win, but that she needed to consider the consequences so that she might never work again in the computer industry. And frankly, the part of it was she was supporting me and my two sisters, younger sisters, and she felt she couldn't take that risk. And so she definitely put a crack in things. And she told Auerbach when she left there eventually that they were open to a lawsuit. And they ended up after that promoting some women after she left, because she said, basically, look, I was told I had a good suit. I didn't sue you, but you'd better straighten things out. Otherwise, you're going to be in some big legal trouble down the road.
Tim, can you remember when you first really realized what your mom had done, how old you were, or maybe, you know, maybe was it a retelling of the story a few times?
Well, I don't remember exactly when, but I was certainly pretty young. I remember hearing the story, and I would, because I definitely talked to my parents about what they had done, and I remember hearing about this, that, and asking questions. I remember saying to my mom, how come no one else knows this? How come no one knows about all the first computer programmers being women? Why doesn't anyone know that? And she said, well, I really don't know why people don't know it. I mean, it just wasn't part of the story, because even back then, this has been back in the, I was born in 54, so back in the 60s sometime, you know, the image of computer programmers was, this was men doing this high-tech stuff, complicated stuff. And I said, why didn't anyone know this? He said, well, I don't know. I mean, people just didn't. So it puzzled me, and I always thought the story should get out there.
Kathy, were you also surprised when you came across this history much later in the 80s that you hadn't heard it somewhere else before?
Oh, I was shocked. The history of computing, as I had been taught, it was the history of men. So to find out that women were among the pioneers was outstanding.
Well, and it was a role model for you. And Kathy, I don't know if you want to tell this story, but I always just found interesting, you told the story about your son and his reaction to who could be a computer programmer. I mean, do you want to tell that story?
Sure, absolutely. My son, who's my older child, grew up meeting Gene and Kay and Betty. He grew up with the research that I was doing and the oral histories that I was doing of the ENIAC programmers. And when he was about 5, he came to me and he said, Mom, I know that women can be computer programmers, but can men be computer programmers too? And I remember thinking that he was probably the only child in the world with that kind of view of computer history.
Did you assure him that the answer was yes?
I assured him that the answer was absolutely yes, and that the best programming teams had women and men, and that he should definitely learn how to program computers. And he is a computer programmer now.
Good for him. Tim, there's a good story about your son at the Kalamazoo Area Math and Science Center that I think it would be nice to share as well.
There's a computer science class they have at the Math and Science Center, and the teacher was going through, you know, the history of computers, and he was showing various slides, and he popped up in a slide of a picture of the ENIAC. And my mom was in the picture, and he said, that's my grandmother. And the teacher said, no, it isn't. You're just making that up, Alex. And he said, no, that really is, you know. And so actually, after he became convinced it was, my mom was visiting Kalamazoo, and he had her give a talk over at the Math and Science Center, which, you know, was interesting. I mean, my mom remarks that the girls really were excited, that the boys were not so, you know, as interested, you know. But and talks like that are helpful. I mean, I actually found the internet recently, a posting by someone who had been at that talk, a young woman who was at that talk, who ended up going into computing. And she said that she heard this talk. She mentioned this whole story about my son and you know, and said, when I heard this talk, it gave me some hope that, you know, in going into computers, that I was following a path that other women had followed. And but that was a great story where he just happened to see it, and the teacher didn't believe him at first that it was really his grandmother who was in that picture.
Kathy, what's sort of the legacy here that you hope people will remember about ENIAC, Jean Jennings Bardic, and the other women who were involved?
Well, maybe we should name them so people know all the names.
Good idea,
it was,
yes.
Kathleen Mockley Antonelli, Marlon Westcoff-Meltzer, Ruth Lichterman Teitelbaum, of course, Jean Jennings Bardic, Betty Schneider Holberton, and Frances Bylus Spence. And these six women should really go down in history as among our programming pioneers, along with Grace Hopper and Ada Lovelace, and as founding a real era of programming and computing. And they should go down in history for their philosophy of making computing and programming much more accessible. They had an almost impossible job to do. They learned to program the ENIAC without any manuals. There were no programming languages, no compilers. They had to figure out the ENIAC from its logical and wiring diagrams, and then figure out how to wire it. And their big commitment at the end of World War II was to make computing easier and make programming easier. And Jean went on to do it, and Betty Holberton went on to create the first sort routine. She created the first software application. I mean, these women did incredible things that led to the modern era and to the computers we use all the time and so easily. So I think they've got a great legacy and that everyone should know about it.
Kathy, if someone is interested in seeing your documentary, at what point might they be able to see it and where?
Thank you for asking. The place to find out statuses of the documentary is on my website, which is www.eniacprogrammers.org. And it will probably be available the second quarter of 2014. We're still working on distribution. But if schools, if teachers are interested, they should shoot me a note at eniacprogrammers.org. There's an email address there, and I'll put them on a list, and I'll let them know when it comes out and how to get it.
We're hoping that a lot more, just like my mom's picture, but now people will know what it is. I mean, so in other words, if a computer science history teacher or a science teacher at a high school wants to, show something about the history of computers, this will give a valuable resource to them to be able to show that history included women. And women, as Kathy said, doing a very hard task. I mean, originally to program the ENIAC, you not only need to figure out the logic of what needed to happen when, you actually needed to reconnect some of the wires. You needed to say, okay, for this particular programmer, the output of the square rooter needs to go into the divider, and then needs to go from the divider to the adder, and so it needed to be rewired to do a program. And then later on, that's not the way computers work today. And as I said, my mom worked in the team that converted it to a stored program computer where you could you didn't have to rewire the machine every time you did a new problem.
We've been discussing the book Pioneer Programmer, Jean Jennings Bartik and the Computer That Changed the World. Jean Jennings Bartik passed away in 2011. We've been discussing her book with her son, Tim Bartik, an economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research here in Kalamazoo. Tim, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And also Kathy Kleiman, an internet law and policy attorney. She joined us via Skype from Washington, D.C. Kathy Kleiman is also the founder of the ENIAC Programmers Project and executive producer of a documentary forthcoming about the ENIAC programmers. Kathy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me and for covering this wonderful story.
This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Communities in Schools of Kalamazoo has launched a $4.5 million fundraising campaign. Today we're going to talk about what Communities in Schools does in Kalamazoo and the goal of this campaign with Executive Director Pam Kingery. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
And the President of the Board, Carolyn Williams. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's my honor.
Let's start with talking about Communities in Schools. I'm sure many people know the name, but do they know exactly what Communities in Schools does? Tell us a little bit about the organization. What are the services provided?
Well, we place a site coordinator in each of 19 Kalamazoo public schools to connect resources, community resources to students to remove all of the barriers that might exist for them in doing well in school. So we secure the resources of the community, whether it's tutors, mentors, healthcare services, dental care, vision care, all of the things that a child might need to grow and develop. We bring those services to the school so that our site coordinators can connect those services to students so that they can succeed in school.
And we need to make it clear that Communities in Schools does not provide the service. It makes sure that the needs are identified and determined both appropriately, some of them for the entire school building, some of them for individual identified students, so that if they have specific issues, they can be the focus of consistent, long-term attention and service.
More of a liaison, finding the needs and then finding the partners out there who can address those needs.
Exactly.
Communities in Schools launched in Kalamazoo in 2003. It was kind of some other groups had merged together to form Communities in Schools. Did the mission of Communities in Schools or the operations change in any significant way 2 years later when the Kalamazoo Promise was announced?
I don't think our mission changed. I think that our capacity to engage the community changed. The Kalamazoo Promise is an incredible catalyst for everybody to act so that as many students as possible can use the gift of the Kalamazoo Promise.
And many of the supporters, the board members, were originally participants in one of the three originating organizations. So they understood the importance of identifying the supports that would enable the students in the school district to take advantage of the Kalamazoo Promise.
So now there's a $4.5 million fundraising campaign, which is underway. Why have you launched this now? What are you hoping to do?
Well, I'll let Pam speak to the first part of our regular funding activities, and then we'll talk about what our goal is in the campaign.
The campaign is intended to, it's really an operational campaign. Many fundraising campaigns tend to be for capital, tend to be for buildings. This one is for operating expenses so that we can continue this important work, that the community can continue to invest in this whole child strategy that we've developed. When we did our last campaign, we were in 6 schools. We've since grown to 19 schools. Clearly, we have a goal of being in every school so that we can meet student needs. So it is intended to help us continue that work, continue having the capacity to follow students over time, to start with them when they're in elementary school, and if their needs are continuing, to follow them as they progress from middle school to high school and stay on the path to a successful college-ready graduation.
The purpose of the campaign, as we've tried to outline it and sell it, if you will, to the community, is to allow us to sustain our current capacity for after-school support, provide partial school support capacity in our remaining sites. And some of the sites, especially after-school programs, are dependent on federal grant funding, which may or may not be renewed. We want to increase the numbers of students who receive long-term case management, improve and evaluate how we're doing, because we don't want to just slough along and do things just because that's the way they've always wanted to be done. We always in the continuous quality improvement process, increase tutoring and sustain the focus on what we expect that the majority of students can benefit from their participation in the services provided by communities and schools.
How much of an unmet need is there right now out there in the community? And I know that may be tough to really quantify, but what's your sense of, maybe not only how many students do you not reach with the services you currently provide, but what are some services that should be provided that right now just can't be done?
Well, I can tell you absolutely we never have enough tutors. So, Gordon, if you were able as a result of this interview to double the number of tutors that we had, and most of them were standing up and saying, I can tutor in math, you would be my personal hero.
But you'd still be looking for more math tutors,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely. So tutors are a huge need.
And excuse me, one of the important services that communities and schools provides is making sure that the tutor is competent, survives a criminal background check, and has a method of interacting with the student and perhaps the student's parents that is effective and consistent. I think that's very important because many people are well-intentioned in wanting to help, but there are certain skills that are required to be good at the job, and that's one of the things that Communities and Schools does, the training, the evaluation, the background check. That's so important for the safety of both the tutor and the student.
Great point. Mental health services. We never have enough mental health services to meet the needs. So that's something that we're always working on, trying to increase our capacity to address the social-emotional needs of kids, to help kids learn effective coping strategies, both in dealing with their peers as well as in dealing with other life circumstances. Health in general. We want our kids to be healthy. We've made tremendous progress in addressing vision care needs, for example, increasing the number of kids who have follow-up vision exams and get eyeglasses when the exam says that they need eyeglasses. We still have unmet needs there. Dental services, we've grown dental services, but there's more need for dental services. So we're still mobilizing the entire community for this whole child service delivery system. It's a growth process.
And to the extent that the promise has generated an increase in the enrollment of students in the Kalamazoo Public Schools, obviously, that's another issue that we're having to address, because when the promise was announced, I think there were 10,000 students, and my newspaper article recently indicated there were about 13,000 students. So that increases the need for the ability to assess and then provide the services.
Dan Cardinale, who's with the National Communities and Schools Group, was here in Kalamazoo around the time you launched this campaign, and he wrote about this in the Huffington Post, made a couple of interesting observations I'd like you to react to. One is that he attended a luncheon with a diverse group of nonprofit leaders exploring ways they could support the city's public schools. The local food bank was there, housing advocates, mental health experts, even the Kalamazoo Symphony. Does he have a point here that that if you're going to really bring up the school system and make sure that education is a whole child process, as you say, that there's a lot of different actors involved, some of whom we might not think of at first blush?
Absolutely. We used to talk about the village raising our kids, and really it suggests that we all have an investment. I think that was Dan's point, is when all of us have an investment in our kids doing well, we all have skin in the game. We all have something to contribute. I think communities and schools, our role is to try to mobilize all of those investments so that we're not saying, well, school, good luck with educating our kids. We're all saying it is our responsibility. We all have something to bring to the table.
And the reference to the symphony is not quite so out of the box. I mean, the symphony over many years has had an education component and gone into the schools to provide like the instrument petting zoo and performances. But this is a consistent program based on the El Sistema musical education program from Venezuela, where the symphony provides an after-school education component for children who might not otherwise have the opportunity to learn to play an instrument, to read music, to play in a group where each contribution makes the whole that much better. So I don't think that that's outside the box at all. It's part of what makes us civilized human beings.
And our partnership with the symphony is a terrific example of this investment of partners that folks might think are unlikely partners that we've begun to experience as very likely partners.
So as I mentioned, it's a $4.5 million campaign. How much of that has been raised so far?
About 52%. So we're more than halfway there due to the incredible generosity of our funders, donors, and contributors to the campaign to date. So we're very excited to keep going toward that $4.5 million.
And it is a three-year campaign, so we never expected to raise the full amount within the first year of our efforts. And we are working very hard to engage the traditional and the non-traditional contributors to this effort, because we think it's a community investment in our children.
Thank you very much, both of you, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for giving us your time.
Pam Kingery is Executive Director of Kalamazoo Communities and Schools. Carolyn Williams is the president of the board and a retired Kalamazoo County probate judge. You can find links with more information and longer versions of both of the interviews on today's program at wmuk.org. This is West at Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.